Alright. So now it should have everything there. Alright, we are doing a House of Prayer, part 2. And we have up on the screen Zechariah 14, 8 and 9. It shall be in that day that living water shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea, and half of them toward the hinder sea. In summer and in winter shall it be, and Yahweh shall be king over all the earth, and that day shall there be one Yahweh, and his name one. And towards the end of this exhortation, we'll get to those waters which will emanate from the temple. In our previous talk in this series, we considered the general description of the house of prayer for all people appearing as the frame of a city on the south. We noted then that most cities that Ezekiel would have been familiar with in his time would have had a strong outer wall creating a perimeter, additional walls on the interior forming separate districts, and a palace or temple at the innermost point. So certainly we can see how this temple structure would be perceived as a city from a long ways off, and as we'll note throughout our talk today, it will actually function very much as a city. We also consider the man whose appearance was like the appearance of brass that Ezekiel sees when he is drawn closer to the structure. We noted that this man of brass is the chief architect of the sanctuary, who measures with a reed and a line of flax and represents the immortalized Jesus, the branch, who will build the temple of the Lord and who wields a scepter of righteousness and a line of judgment. Finally, we began our consideration of the relative layout, size, and function of the various portions of the temple complex, beginning with the outer wall, over a mile long in each direction, the identical outer and inner gate structures, each standing 120 feet high and 100 feet in depth, the outer court, 160 feet wide, not including the porches of the gates, it's 180 if you include those, and extending 5,280 feet, exactly 1 mile, between the corner towers. Finally, we looked at the corner towers themselves, where the priests will boil the trespass and sin offerings and bake the meal offerings. They are 360 feet wide, matching up to the full width of the gates and the outer court, and they stand 480 feet high. So I recognize there's a lot to look at on that screen, but hopefully that's a good review of what we did last time. This morning, I'd like to finish up our consideration of the outer structure complex, specifically regarding the particulars and function of the large buildings between each of the gates, and briefly, the use of the six little chambers within each gate. In the KJV, the buildings spanning the space between the gates have been translated simply as chambers, and come from the Hebrew word lishka, meaning a room in a building for storage, eating, or lodging, chamber or parlor. And that's a fairly accurate description of the use of these buildings, as we shall see. And last time we mentioned, as an aside, the lattice work that will cover these buildings as you approach them. So some think that maybe glass in there, which would allow a reflection of light, which will be seen shining from a distance. You think of Zion being shining from a distance as well. And you also have the idea of there being basically an atrium where the plants and vines and so forth can grow up on the outside. So we mentioned that last time. We're not planning on going into that today, but you can see here on the picture that concept. In order to differentiate these large, spacious chambers, which we'll get to the dimensions in a minute, from the comparatively small little chambers on either side of the gate, Brother Sully instead inserts the word cella, or in the plural, cellae. As noted in our previous talk, the word cella is borrowed from Roman and Greek architecture to describe a large interior chamber or set of chambers within a columned building. And you can see some examples here on the slide. Here we've got the Parthenon in Greece on the top left, the Pantheon in Rome on the top right, and there's also some kind of temple in the middle. I don't recall which one that one is. You can also see similarities in the tabernacle on the bottom right. You have columns or posts holding up the curtains of the outer perimeter, as well as the framing of the inside of the tabernacle itself, where the priest could view the cherubim through the lattice work, so to speak. So lest we think this actually was borrowed from Roman or Greek architecture, We know, of course, the tabernacle preceded that, and so did Ezekiel's vision. But just as a term that Brother Sully uses in his book on the Temple of Ezekiel's Prophecy, that word cella is used to describe these rooms surrounded by columns. We'd like now to consider the number and dimensions of these buildings. So let's turn to Ezekiel chapter 40. We'll be in either Ezekiel 40 or 42 for the majority of this talk. Ezekiel 40 verse 17 reads, "Then brought he me into the outward court, and lo, there were chambers, and a pavement made for the court round about 30 chambers upon the pavement." Here it is noted there are 30 of these chambers in the outer court. At this point in the vision, Ezekiel has only seen the east, north, and south sides of the outer court complex, which includes the outer wall, the gate buildings, and the outer court itself. Recall that the inner gate structure forms the boundary of the separate place inward, and is referred to as the inner court, so it is not being counted here, though it does mirror the outer court in many respects. Thus, knowing that Ezekiel has only seen three sides, and he has counted a total of 30 cella buildings on the whole of the outer court, that leaves us with 10 cella buildings on each side, north, east, and south. And so here you can see highlighted 30 buildings, which Ezekiel has referenced, that put a little yellow rectangle on the 30. Ezekiel 42, 1 and 2 describes these same buildings on the inner gate structure. So the same type of buildings, but on the inner gate structure. Chapter 42, verses 1 and 2. "Then he brought me forth into the utter court," or outer court, "the way toward the north, and brought me into the chamber that was over against the separate place, which was before the building toward the south," or toward the north, excuse me. "Before, the length of 100 cubits was the north door, and the breadth was 50 cubits." Here Ezekiel is brought out of the circular temple building described in the previous chapter, in chapter 41. He enters the outer court on the north side, and then turning and entering one of the cella buildings of the inner court. He is standing in the door of the cella of the inner court, which is the boundary of the separate place, looking to the north across the outer court. So here on the slide, Ezekiel is this yellow triangle. So he went north, he came into the outer court, he turned around and entered through a door of one of the cella buildings, and he's standing in the doorway. Thus, before, or in front of the inner court cella that he's standing in, the length of 100 cubits. This refers to the full length of the outer court between the gate buildings, including the porches on each side, which we discussed in our previous talk. Meanwhile, the breadth that Ezekiel mentions in verse 2 is in reference to the inner court cella building that he is standing in, which is noted as 50 cubits. This comes as no surprise because we've already had the measure of the breadth of the gates, given as 50 cubits as well, indicating a continuous structure from corner tower to corner tower. So it'll look like one complete structure with the gates themselves being openings that you can pass through into the outer court. Verse 8 of chapter 42, regarding the cella of the outer court, agrees with this measurement, that is the 50 cubits. So verse 8, "For the length of the chambers," or cella, "that were in the outer court was 50 cubits, and lo, before the temple were 100 cubits." So as an aside here, the inner court buildings are referred to in this verse as part of the temple structure itself again. Recall again, the door of the inner court gates of the cella and the cella buildings constitute the boundary of the separate place. So I put the separate place up here on the slide. The edge of the separate place would be the door, which is what Ezekiel is standing at in the previous verse we looked at. So everything on the inside of that would be considered the separate place, and of course you have the most holy, which we'll get to in a future talk, inside the circular temple. Again, the 100 cubit measure of the outer court before or in front of the inner court buildings is noted. Given these dimensions, 50 cubits of breadth, so again about 100 feet if we're taking 2 foot per royal cubit, and the number of cella buildings spanning each side of the structure, which again was 10 on each side that he counted, so he had 30. If we include the inner court cella buildings, that'd be 20 on each side. How wide are these buildings? We know how deep they are, how wide are they? We are not directly told, so we have to rely on some math and some assumptions. I lost my place. Here we go. We already know that the complete length of each side is 3,000 cubits. Each tower is 180 cubits square. Since there are two towers at each end of the outer court, we subtract a total of 360 cubits, leaving us with the 2,640 cubits to work with. As we mentioned previously, if we're going with 2 feet per cubit, that would be exactly 1 mile. So 280 feet. Now we know that there are 10 cell buildings in the outer court on each side, meaning there are either 9 or 11 gates that divide each cell building from the next. Brother Sully suggests 11 gates, which would allow for a gate at each end of the structure, directly abutting each corner tower. And so you can see those 11 gates here on the slide, and we know also we'll read later, water comes out from under the threshold of the gates, so you can easily see where they're coming out. We also know that the interior of each gate building is 25 cubits wide. So the interior of each gate building is 25 cubits wide, which is also the measure of the innermost part of each arch. The posts that hold the archways of the gates are 6 cubits wide. Thus, from the center of each post, which would be the outermost point of each arch, to the center of the next post is 31 cubits total. So another way to think about it is each complete arch is 31 cubits from one side to the other. If we assume that all the arches are uniform in width for the entirety of the length of the outer court, that is across all the gates and all the cella buildings between the corner towers, which certainly makes sense from structurally speaking, then we can divide the 2,640 cubit length of the outer court by the 31 cubit width of each full archway to determine the total number of arches that we have. In doing so, we arrive at 85 complete arches, and we have 5 cubits remaining. Or another way to look at it, 85 arches, which are 31 cubits wide apiece, totals 2,635 cubits, and an additional 5 cubits gets us to the total of 2,640. Brother Henry Sully suggests that the remainder 5 cubits would allow for an extra 2.5 cubits on each end of the outer court, where the final column will merge with the corner tower. Recall that each of the columns or posts were measured at 6 cubits wide, from which 2 arches would normally extend, each arch taking up 3 cubits width at the top of the post. In the case of a post abutting the corner towers, as pictured here, they would only be 5.5 cubits wide, which allows for the completion of one full archway, taking up 3 cubits, and another 2.5 cubits width, which will likely merge with the corner tower in order to transfer the lateral loads of the cella and gate buildings of the outer and inner courts. So that allows those two corner towers on each end to hold the lateral loads that come off of those archways that extend an entire mile. So that's quite a lot of loading that has to hold up. All right, now I'm going to pull this all together. We've gotten the measure of the full width of the outer court, the width of the gate buildings, the width of the arches, and the remainder 5 cubits allotted for attaching to the towers. Let's return then to our question of the width of these cella buildings. So now it'll make sense why we went through all that. To determine the width of each of the cella buildings, we need to first subtract out the width of each gate. Since we have 11 gates, which are 25 cubits wide each, that totals 275 cubits attributable to those gates. We also subtract out that remainder 5 cubits, the 2.5 cubits on each end. Again, that wouldn't be part of a gate, and that wouldn't be part of a cella building either. In doing so, we arrive at 2,360 cubits remaining. Dividing this distance among 10 cella buildings leaves each one with 236 cubits of width, which is about 472 feet, so 472 feet wide. Assuming each building is uniform in width, that means each one is exactly the same width as each other, when we consider the depth of each building is set at 50 cubits, or 100 feet, then the floor space amounts to 11,800 square cubits, or 47,200 square feet per cella building. So each one of those buildings, assuming they were all the same size exactly, we'll talk in a minute about why we think they might actually be slightly different widths, would be 47,200 square feet apiece. And that number does not take into account the fact that each building has multiple levels. So we'll touch on that in a moment as well. Now, there is one quandary that we have regarding these cella buildings if we assume they are all of equal length. So again, I don't think they are. Remember, we calculated 85 total archways that span the length of the outer court. When you remove 11 of those arches, one for each gate building, that leaves you with 74 total arches remaining for 10 cella buildings. If we base the assumption that the cella buildings are all the same width, then we run into the problem of having 7.4 arches per building, which that just doesn't work. However, this problem can be alleviated if the cella buildings are of differing widths. So here are two suggestions that I came up with that would still allow for a symmetrical layout, and then we'll look at what Brother Sully had to do, or what he put in. So to make a symmetrical layout, you could have 8 of them with 8 arches, and 2 of them with 5 arches, and that would still total up to 74. You could also have 6 of them with 7 arches, and 4 of them with 8 arches, again totaling 74. And you could set them up in a symmetrical layout. However, it is evident in Brother Sully's sketches that he was of the opinion that the gates and cella buildings would not be in a symmetrical layout, but rather a greater number of gates would lie toward the west. Here is the arch count that he has per building. So I've got it down there at the bottom, but also I counted them up on the top. And if you actually get really close, you can count all the archways in each of the columns it lands on. So starting on the right, he has 9, and it continues all the way down, and by the time you get to the end on the west, you've got 5 arches. This seems a logical setup, given that the waters that burst forth from the thresholds of the gate form a stream that must be crossed by all visitors to the temple. And that stream, as we will talk about towards the end of this talk, gets gradually deeper the further east you go. Thus, the majority of people will be crossing at the more shallow points, and thus more gates toward the western side would make access to the temple more efficient. If anyone else has any other suggestions, you can let me know afterwards. But it does seem to make sense why it might be set up that way. So we'll have to wait and see what the true measure is. Moving on, we noted that there were multiple levels in each of these cella buildings. We get this from Ezekiel 42, 3 and 4. Ezekiel 42, 3 and 4. Over against the 20, which were for the inner court, and over against the pavement, which was for the outer court, was gallery against gallery in 3 stories. And before the chambers was a walk of 10 cubits, a 10 cubits breadth inward, a way of 1 cubit, and our doors toward the north. In verse 3, the word cubits is in italics following over against the 20, because it is not in the original text. The 20 here are in reference to the inner court cella on the northern and southern sides, which are set aside for the Levitical priests. If you look down to verse 13, it states, "Then said he unto me, the north chambers and the south chambers, which are before the separate place, they be holy chambers, where the priests that approach unto Yahweh shall eat the most holy things. There shall they lay the most holy things, and the meat offering, and the sin offering, and the trespass offering, for the place is holy." So here we have the function of the inner court cell as described, and we'll get into the function of the outer court cell later. So again, you've got the 20 there, and just as an aside, we'll note later, the entirety of the eastern portion is set aside for the prince, so that's why that's not included in that count. Going back to verse 3, these cella buildings are described as having galleries that are connected together, gallery against gallery, in 3 stories. The word gallery is atik, meaning a ledge or offset in a building, a gallery. In architectural terms, a gallery is indicative of a large open terrace, balcony, or promenade inside of the building or facing a courtyard, or both. So certainly you can see how that fits in here. Here are some examples next to Brother Sully's sketches. So on the left, you have Brother Sully's sketches. On the right, you've got the Roman Colosseum at the top, so the outward portion of that, where you see all those archways, which are open to the outside, would be galleries. And then you have 2 art museums here on the bottom right. So usually when we think of a gallery, we tend to think of museums that have galleries in them. The one in the middle, you can look down onto the inside. The one on the bottom is open air. Inside, you've got these columns and towers, but then it looks out across a courtyard, which would be very similar to what we have actually in Brother Sully's sketches here in Ezekiel's temple. Verse 3 again notes that these galleries are in three stories. Brother Sully suggests that these three stories are in addition to the ground floor, thus a total of four levels. And again, you can see that on the slide there on the left. You have the first floor, which is level with each gate building floor, and then three galleries in the cella buildings above the ground floor. So if you remember, Ezekiel had to go into the outer court to enter into the cella buildings. And you can note on the sketch here, there are no doors to enter the cella from the outside. So you have to enter into the gate, into the outer court, turn around, and go left or right, and then enter the doors to get into the cella buildings. So there will be a ground floor and then four galleries. If you remember from last time, the height of these was 60 cubits, or 120 feet. We mentioned that earlier. Thus, there's enough room for each of these galleries to have a ceiling of 30 feet. And there are actually verses that would indicate that they're not all the same height, and you can kind of tell that in Brother Sully's sketches here as well. But there's enough room there. If each one was divided evenly, they would have 30-foot ceilings. So quite a large space. You have 472 feet long, 100 feet in depth, and then each floor 30 feet height. And these are large buildings, so we'll eventually get to what's the purpose of these buildings. Verse 4 also adds, and before, or in front of, the cella, was a walk of 10 cubits breadth inward, by way of one cubit, and their doors toward the north. Thus, a walkway of 10 cubits breadth extends towards the outer court from each cella building. These walkways are of equal length, equal breadth, to the porches of the gates, thus forming a continuous covered walkway in the outer court. It is noted that this walk is a way of one cubit, better rendered, byway of one cubit, indicating that the floor of these covered porches of the cella and the gates are one cubit higher than the pavement of the outer court. Now, on this one that I brought up to show that, if you look at the full sketch, which shows this is the outer court building on the right that you're looking at. If you show the inner court building, that one actually doesn't have a step. So it's on these outer court ones he has it on. But anyway, you have a covered walkway the entire length. So you could be either inside the building itself, but then, of course, every time you got to a gate, you'd have to exit and go around. But if you wanted to walk and have a covering, you could walk the entire length in this porch. Otherwise, you could be in a pavement, which is between the two buildings, and that would be open air all the way down to the end. Knowing then that there are multiple levels of these buildings, and each level equates to roughly 47,000 square feet apiece, there might be some variety to that. What are these to be used for? We already read about the purpose of these buildings for the inner court cella in verse 13. They are holy chambers where the priest will eat and or lay the most holy things. That is, the meal offerings, the sin offerings, and trespass offerings. Let's also look at chapter 40, verses 38 to 43. Just to give us some context of what happens with the sacrifices here. We didn't look at this last time. I thought it was worth it to read it this time. Ezekiel 40, 38 to 43. And the chambers and the entries thereof were by the posts of the gates where they washed the burnt offerings. And in the porch of the gate were two tables on this side and two tables on that side to slay thereon the burnt offering and the sin offering and trespass offering. And at the side without, as one goeth up to the entry of the north gate, were two tables. And on the other side, which was at the porch of the gate, were two tables. Four tables were on this side and four tables on that side. By the side of the gate, eight tables whereupon they slew their sacrifices. And the four tables were of hewn stone for the burnt offering and a cubit and a half long and a cubit and a half broad, and one cubit high, whereupon also they laid the instruments, wherein they slew the burnt offering and sacrifice. And within were hooks, a hand broad, fastened round about, and upon the tables was the flesh of the offering. So here we have a description of the slaying and washing of the various burnt offerings at the outside of the outer gate and porch of the outer, The burnt offerings are slain at the outside of the outer gate and the porch of the outer gate, on the north side. You can see those slaying and washing tables in the porch of the outer gate on the bottom left side of the screen here. So if you look at right where the word porch is, on either side of there are two slaying tables. And then if you look all the way down at the bottom, which appears to maybe be cut off a little bit, you can see the tops of them anyway. There are slaying tables out there as well. So those are where they get slain. However, it's at the inner court gate the part where the Levitical priests are, the sacrifices are prepared for different purposes. Some portions, or sometimes whole sacrifices, depending on the case, will be transported to the inner temple structure where the sons of Zadok will take them to be burned upon the altar. We'll get to that eventually in a future talk. Other portions will be prepared for transport to the corner towers, which we noted in our last talk will be used for the cooking and baking of these offerings. You can see that in Ezekiel 46, verse 20. The prepared food will then be distributed back to the cella buildings for the sustenance of the mortal Levitical priests. But what about the outer court cella buildings where the mortal population may enter? First, it should be noted that the entirety of the eastern portion of this temple complex is reserved for the prince. You can see that in chapter 43, 1-3. Also, the northern and southern inner gate structures, as we've already seen, are reserved for the Levitical priests only. The particulars of the western side are unspecified, but it is assumed that it matches the north and south in most respects. And as an aside, Brother Sully suggests that both rows of buildings on the western side might be usable by the mortal population on the western side, so we'll have to wait and see. Some of the sketches are like this one here, where he shows them having gate structures and cella buildings. Some of the other ones, it's a solid wall all the way across the western side, and there's no gates whatsoever. So we'll have to see which one it ends up being. Of course, that would just mean there's more rooms available for, we'll get to what they're for here in a minute. Get ahead of myself. Thus, only the outer court and its buildings on northwest and south sides are open to the mortal population of the earth. So in this slide, I've blocked off everything else that cannot be entered into by the mortal population. Of course, they can't enter into the center either, because you have to get through the gates of the inner court to get there. Further, Ezekiel 46:9 says, "But when the people of the land shall come before Yahweh in the solemn feast, he that entereth in by the way of the north gate to worship shall go out by the way of the south gate, and he that entereth by the way of the south gate shall go forth by the way of the north gate. He shall not return by the way of the gate wherein he came in, but he shall go forth over against it." So there is an orderly movement of individuals using the western side of the outer court to travel from north to south or south to north. With that in mind, I'd like to quote from the Temple of Ezekiel's prophecy, beginning on page 82, regarding the activities to be held in the cella buildings used by the mortal populace. And at first I attempted to rephrase what he had, but honestly he did a much better job at it, so we're just going to quote directly from it. "When the distance to be covered by each visitant to the temple, as delineated on the map of the Holy Oblation," and he's talking about traveling from Yahweh Shema up to the temple and back, "when that distance is realized, something like 25 miles, the necessity for some provision for feeding the people before leaving the sanctuary becomes manifest. But apart from the necessity, the deity has a distinct purpose in this direction. As already mentioned, see the following testimony. In this mountain shall the Lord of hosts make unto all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wine on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of wine on the lees well refined." The mountain referred to is Mount Zion in Jerusalem, where Yahweh is to reign before his ancients gloriously. See the last verse of the previous chapter. We may be perfectly sure that when the Lord sets his hand to do this, the feast will be a vast and glorious affair. In the mountain of the Lord it will be seen, and in the service of his temple. And so, if you remember from one of our previous talks, we talked about all the feasts that will occur during the Kingdom Age, and certainly you need a lot of room for these feasts to take place. Continuing, "But what part of the house is the eating to take place? Surely in those delightfully sheltered galleries in the outer court, and the upper stories of these buildings which flank the outside wall, and the double row of buildings on the western side, ample provision will exist for this part of the program. These galleries comprise rooms, each say 100 feet in length and about 50 wide. Over the porches of a terrace or gallery extends the full length of the outer court between the corner courts or kitchens, from whence, along the terraces, the food can be quickly conveyed. There would be something like 1,776 rooms in each story of the outer court buildings. Half of them, or 888, might be used for feeding the multitude, the remaining portion being used for special purposes. If the buildings are three stories high, there would be 2,664 dining halls." He's subtracting 888 from each one of those. "Each larger than most banqueting halls. In these dining parlors, the worshippers may be regaled and that feast which the deity makes unto all peoples of the earth. We may well forbear to calculate the number of people who could be entertained in such a suite of rooms. At a shrewd guess, we may safely say 300,000 or 400,000 at one sitting. But the charm of the arrangement is that this immense number thrice could go up, thrice told, could go up and be served without the least confusion or crush, meaning, crowds of people that can't move. They enter the gates, they pass into the broad outer court. The oblation or portion which each worshiper brings, and which may be used for food, is elevated to the terrace overhead and conveyed to the kitchens. The worshippers, upon returning from the central building after judgment, pass through the lower stories of the cella to the lifts at the side of the gateways. We'll get to those in a little bit. They ascend to the dining hall cella above, and there obtain food prepared and served by the ministers of the house. That, of course, would be the Levitical priests. The lines of traffic are not crossed in all this service. In fact, the plan solves a problem which many military men have found difficulty in solving. That is, how to feed, without confusion, millions of people. Never in the history of man has such a thing been done effectively. Large multitudes, such as a vast army in a campaign, may have been provisioned, but not in so small a space. Spread over a wide tract of country, the thing has been done with more or less confusion and breakdown. Here, it will be different. The boiled meat, probably served cool, the baked meat, the luscious fruit, and the cheering wine will form a repast of exquisite scents, needing nothing further in the way of embellishment or sumptuousness. I would say he's probably embellishing quite a bit here, but that's all right, at least with his language. We're almost done here. The feast will, no doubt, be a feast in a larger sense than of mere eating and drinking, although the one is an important and necessary element of the other. To eat and drink in company is an exhilarating stimulus leading up to the more perfect enjoyment of fraternal intercourse and mental interchange of soul. The basis of this intellectual and moral treat in the temple will be the occasion of the gathering, and following close upon that, matters of interest to each individual. This feast of reason and flow of soul will be qualified, but heightened immensely, by the evidence of the divine presence. Ah, how different now! The memorials of the deity are almost entirely absent in all Gentile pleasure gatherings, which manifest a shameful disregard of him who is the author of their being. The writer well remembers visiting the Colonial and Indian Exposition held in London during the summer of 1886, and so far as outward sign went, with one humble exception, no indication could be found in that assembly directing the minds to the source and giver of all things, from whom came the skill, the beauty, the riches, and the life of those present. And then the final quote on this point. In the future, all this will be changed, and the essential feature of the whole fabric will be honor and glory to the Creator. This will find expression in the talk of the people. And then he quotes from Psalm 145. They shall speak of the glory of thy kingdom, and talk of thy power. They shall declare thy mighty acts and the glorious majesty of thy kingdom. They shall meditate upon thy wondrous work, and speak of thy terrible acts. They shall declare thy greatness, and utter the memory of thy great goodness. They shall sing of thy righteousness, and their mouth shall speak the praise of the Lord. Unquote. One final consideration for today. We mentioned last time, and we read in this lengthy quote, regarding the use of lifts, to get between the floors of the cella buildings. This is the suggested use of the little chambers, or the runner chambers, as other translators have, whose dimensions, 6 cubits square, or 12 feet square, are about double that of a modern freight elevator. Considering the amount of people moving through this structure, as well as the need to transport large portions of food and or sacrifices to various floors, this seems to be a sufficient size for the task. Again, if it's a lift or an elevator, if you consider trying to move that many people as well as food upstairs, it would not work. I have one more quote from him on this thought. As to the means of ascent from one story to the other, one thing appears quite certain. The way up is not by staircases, for none are specified. This need not be a matter of surprise, considering the height and extent of the buildings. One can easily surmise that staircases would be an inconvenient mode of ascent. At the same time, it may be appropriate to suggest that the modern convenience lifts, or even traveling conveyors, are contemplated in this specification. It would not be the only instance where latter-day inventions have been foreshadowed in the Bible. Considering the constructional character of the gate buildings, it is not difficult to conceive of a simple conveyance bending over from one side to the other, by which any number of people could be conveniently conveyed to and from the upper stories of the buildings of the outer court. In chapter 47, Ezekiel speaks of water gushing out from under the threshold of the gates. From this, it may be surmised that hydraulic lifts may be installed in the temple. They could be constructed so as to act automatically. Whatever the means of ascent intended, whatever be the means of ascent intended, and whatever be the position of the contrivance for effecting this purpose, the general deductions as to the construction and character of the buildings are in no way affected. And then, of course, you might remember when Brother Scott Cram had a talk on this, and he showed an elevator where one side was filling with water and would lift up and it would drain out and it would bring it back down. I was not going to attempt to try to explain that, but we'll have to see how these function at the time. We'd like to conclude by considering the water flowing through the temple in Ezekiel 47, as he's just mentioned. This will also serve as our transition into the memorials. Let's go ahead and uncover these. Let me go ahead and turn the slide. You can follow along with Ezekiel's movements at the bottom of the slide here, and in the bottom right shows a suggestive layout of the conduits of water from the altar. So one of the thoughts is that the water will reach down to the inner temple and then may be conveyed possibly underground or by surface water all the way to the outer court buildings, where it may be going under the cella buildings, which is why it gushes out from the thresholds. But again, there'll be a great amount of hydraulic pressure and head coming from the top of the mountain coming down there. So that leads Brother Sully at least to believe it will be hydraulic lifts involved. Okay, Ezekiel 47, we'll read verses 1 through 12. Afterward, he brought me again to the door of the house, and behold, water is issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward, for the forefront of the house stood toward the east, and the waters came down from under the right side of the house at the south side of the altar. Then brought he me out the way of the gate northward, and led me about the way without unto the utter gate, or outer gate, by the way that looketh eastward. So now he's in the, if you're looking or following along here, he's at number 3 in the middle. And behold, there ran out waters on the right side. So to his right. And when the man that had the line in his hand went forth eastward, he measured 1,000 cubits, and he brought me through the waters, and the waters were to the ankles. And again he measured 1,000, and brought me through the waters, and the waters were to the knees. And again he measured 1,000, and brought me through, the waters were to the loins. Afterward he measured 1,000, and it was a river that I could not pass over. For the waters were risen, waters to swim in, a river that could not be passed over. So just pause here for a minute. You can see that on the top part of the slide here, the 1,000 cubit measures. And once you get to the end, he has waters of swimming referred to in this verse. Continuing in verse 6. And he, that is the measuring angel here, he said unto me, Son of man, hast thou seen this? Then he brought me and caused me to return to the brink of the river. And when I had returned, behold, at the brink of the river were very many trees, on the one side and on the other. Then said he unto me, These waters issue out toward the east country, and go down into the desert, and go into the sea, which being brought forth into the sea, the waters shall be healed. And it shall come to pass that everything that liveth, which moveth whithersoever the river shall come, shall live. And there shall be a very great multitude of fish, because these waters shall come thither. For they shall be healed, and everything shall live whither the river cometh. And it shall come to pass that the fishers shall stand upon it, from Engedi even unto Eneglaim. They shall be a place to spread forth nets. Their fish shall be according to their kinds, as the fish of the great sea, exceeding many. But the miry places thereof, and the marshes thereof, or the marishes thereof, shall not be healed, they shall be given to salt. And by the river upon the bank thereof, on this side and on that side, shall grow all trees for meat or for food, whose leaf shall not fade, neither shall the fruit thereof be consumed. It shall bring forth a new fruit, according to his months, because their waters they issued out of the sanctuary, and the fruit thereof shall be for meat, and the leaf thereof for medicine. All right, so there's quite a lot we're going to look at here. Here Ezekiel is shown the waters emanating from under the threshold of the house headed eastward, forming a stream on the north and south sides that gets gradually deeper as they head east. So again, you see those 1,000 cubit measures. You have the waters of the ankles, the waters of the knees, waters of the loins, and the waters of swimming. Notably, both the man whose appearance was like brass, representing Christ, and Ezekiel passed through these waters. What is the signification of this? Verse 6 notes, Son of man, hast thou seen this? So there's a purpose to this having been done. Let's quote it again from Brother Sully. Whoops. I forgot I don't have this one on here. Okay, you're just going to have to listen. This is on page 92 of the Temple of Ezekiel's Prophecy. Since Ezekiel is a man of sign, one inference is that none will be able to enter the temple without first passing through the water. What Ezekiel did in the figure, others must actually do, and none will be able to enter the house without washing their feet. In this way, the temple precincts will be kept clean. Such a custom will also benefit those who visit the temple, who themselves will be refreshed by ablutions after their long journey thither. So it'll be, after a 25-mile journey, it'll be nice to go through that water. But this suggestion does not sufficiently elucidate the object of the question, especially in view of the fact that the measuring angel accompanying Ezekiel through the water. Now we have seen that the expression Son of Man is particularly related to Jesus Christ, who himself passed through water before his showing to Israel. When John was baptizing in Jordan, Jesus came to him and demanded to be baptized of him, Matthew 3:13. Being acquainted with the holy and blameless life of the one who stood before him, John naturally demurred, saying, I have need to be baptized of thee, and comest thou to me? Jesus, however, persisted in his request, saying, Suffer it to be so now, for thus it becometh us to fulfill all righteousness, Matthew 3:15. Then Jesus was baptized, thus complying with the divinely appointed way of entry into the kingdom of God. For Jesus said to Nicodemus, Except the man be born of water and of the Spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of God, John 3:5. Consequently, ever since the appearing of Christ, all believers who have become heirs of the kingdom have been baptized. Jesus is the head of the community, represented by the line of flax, the community that is, represented by the line of flax in the hand of the measurer when passing through the waters with Ezekiel. Further, the relation which subsists between immersion in water and the accompanying results arising therefrom is indicated by the words of the Apostle John thus. This is from 1 John chapter 5. This is he that came by water and blood, even Jesus Christ. And still further, there are three that bear record, the Spirit, the water, and the blood. 1 John 5, 6 through 8. These three important elements, Spirit, water, and blood, must find a place in the temple arrangements when the kingdom of God is established on the earth. For it is written, the gifts and calling of God are without change. Romans 6:29. These elements may be tabulated thus. Just to tabulate Spirit, water, and blood and how they fit into the temple service. 1. Since the Spirit took up Ezekiel and conveyed him into the inner court, the Spirit witness of the Father will be there. And certainly we'll see that in the person of Jesus, as well as the saints, the sons of Zadok. I would also insert here that those heading to the temple for worship will be led by the Spirit, as are we currently. 2, sacrificial offerings are slain outside the northern entrances. The witness of shed blood will thus be there. I'll also add in here, the sacrifices point back to the shed blood of Christ, who will literally be in the temple in the coming age. 3, a stream of water overflowing, sufficiently deep for conveniently washing feet or for immersion, will be there for a witness to the means of securing eternal life. Thus, Ezekiel and the measuring angel passing through the water indicates much more than a ceremonial cleansing of the sanctuary. First, it signifies that just as Jesus was baptized in order to obtain the kingdom, of course, his baptism pointing forward to the work that he was going to do, so all his followers will have to come to him through water. Secondly, since no one can enter the temple without passing through water and under its vapor cloud, we haven't gotten to that yet, there'll be a cloud of vapor that will cover over the inner portion, the nations of the earth will be nationally baptized into Christ, just as the nation of Israel was baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea upon coming out of Egypt. 1 Corinthians 10:1-2. But this national cleansing will not bestow eternal life. This must come through individual confession of sin and baptism. And this is something I didn't really put together until I was reading through this. The provision for baptism and the provision for sacrifices in the temple appear to exist concurrently for the passing over of sin. So let's pause here for a minute. If you consider what's the point of the waters of the knees and eventually of the loins and the swimming, he of course suggests that there will be also be baptism during the time, not just symbolically speaking, walking into the temple, but perhaps literally speaking in the deeper waters. Continuing, this will not be a matter of surprise to those who remember that there are two classes of sins from which the human race needs deliverance. Again, he's talking about trespasses for the being taken care of by the sacrifices, and then also baptism regarding the way into Christ. Firstly, those to which men are inevitably related by reason of their physical constitution, in Romans 5, as we can read. And secondly, individual trespasses. Animal sacrifices may serve for passing over sins which arise from transgressing laws enacted for the regulation of the state. So very similar, we talked about previously, the return of many of the parts of the law of Moses in that respect. But there are sins which appertain to the conscience for which animal sacrifices are not efficacious regarding our sin nature, Hebrews 9. Because their removal can come only by the destruction of sin nature through the exercise of faith in the Son of God. And we would, of course, include baptism as the obedience of faith, or the beginning of our obedience of faith. Thus we read from Acts 13, "Be it known unto you, therefore, men and brethren, that through this man, Jesus, is preached unto you the forgiveness of sins, and by him all that believe are justified from all things, from which you cannot be justified under the law of Moses." In immersion there is recognition of these. And by the offering of sacrifice, there is provision for escape from immediate judgment of the sinner. Those who have been subject to cleansing by immersion and who go up to the temple for worship will need only to wash their feet. Quoting from John 13, "He that is washed needeth not save to wash his feet." This is when Jesus came and washed their feet. And Peter said, "Not my feet only, but also my head and so forth." So again, "He that is washed needeth not to say wash his feet," which means, of course, a careful walk in harmony with divine precepts. Romans 6, 1-6. If this be the significance of Ezekiel's passage through the water, then there is much to see in it. We may well turn again to the question with deepened interest, "Son of man, hast thou seen this?" Unquote. Thus we see that despite some alterations to the worship service in the age to come, he's compared to currently, which are included as a necessity for both the teaching of the nations and to bring about the promised inheritance for Christ and the saints, the means of salvation remains the same. Both we now and those in the age to come, must be associated with the atoning work of Christ, continually washing in the water of the Word. Of course, those literally will be washed in the water as they cross into the temple. Washing the water of the word and working out our salvation with fear and trembling. So our final thought here. In addition to what we've already considered regarding the water issuing from the temple in the future, we also read that these waters go forth as a healing river, teeming with life and supporting trees on either side whose fruit is produced every month and whose leaves will be used for healing. We see this literal blessing of the future age shown in symbol in Revelation 22 regarding our hope to be among those immortalized saints described as the wood of life, with Yahweh's name inscribed in our foreheads, teaching and thus healing the nations. So we have Revelation 22, 1-5. Revelation 22, verse 1, "And he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb. In the midst of the street of it, and on either side of the river, was there the tree, or the wood, plural, of life, which bare 12 manner of fruits, and yielded her fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him. and they shall see his face, and his name shall be in their foreheads, and there shall be no night there, and they need no candle or lamp, neither light of the sun, for the Lord God giveth them light, and they shall reign forever and ever. We see here that the source of this water of life is the throne of God and of the Lamb. Let's look at John chapter 4, beginning at verse 13. The source of the water of life. John 4, beginning at verse 13. This is the woman at the well in Samaria. Jesus answered and said to her, "Whosoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again. But whosoever drinketh of the water that I give him shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. The woman saith unto him, Sir, give me this water, that I thirst not, neither come hither to draw. Jesus saith unto her, Go, call thy husband, and come hither. The woman answered and said, I have no husband. Jesus said unto her, Thou hast well said, I have no husband, for thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband. In that saidest thou truly. The woman saith unto him, Sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Jesus saith unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh, when ye shall neither in this mountain, nor yet at Jerusalem, worship the Father. Ye worship ye know not what. We know not what we worship for salvation. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshippers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. The woman saith unto him, I know that Messiah cometh, which is called Christ. When he is come, he will tell us all things. Jesus saith unto her, I that speak unto thee am he. What comprises this water of life? Jesus says that he is this water of life. Let's read John chapter 6, beginning at verse 35. 35 to 58. Jesus said unto them, I am the bread of life. He that cometh to me shall never hunger, and he that believeth on me shall never thirst. But I said unto you that ye also have seen me and believe not. And all that the Father giveth me shall come to me, and him that cometh to me I will nowise cast out. For I came down from heaven not to do mine own will, but the will of him sent me. And this is the Father's will which hath sent me, that of all which he hath given me I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again at the last day. And this is the will of him that sent me, that every one which seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day. The Jews then murmured at him, because he said, I am the bread which came down from heaven. And they said, Is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How is it then that he saith, I came down from heaven? Jesus therefore answered and said unto them, Murmur not amongst yourselves. No man can come to me, except the Father which hath sent me draw him, and I will raise him up at the last day. It is written in the prophets, And they shall be taught of God. Every man therefore that hath heard and hath learned of the Father cometh unto me. Not that any man hath seen the Father, save he which is of God, he hath seen the Father. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that believeth on me hath everlasting life. I am that bread of life. Your fathers did eat manna in the wilderness and are dead. This is the bread which cometh down from heaven, that a man may eat thereof and not die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If any man eat of this bread, he shall live forever. And the bread that I will give is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world. The Jews therefore strove among themselves, saying, How can this man give us this flesh to eat? Then Jesus said unto them, Verily, verily, I say unto you, except ye eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, ye have no life in you. Whosoever eateth my flesh and drinketh my blood hath eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. For my flesh is meat indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. He that eateth my flesh and drinketh my blood dwelleth in me, and I in him. As the living Father hath sent me, and I live by the Father, so he that eateth me, even he shall live by me. This is that bread which came down from heaven. Not as your fathers did eat manna and are dead. He that eateth of this bread shall live forever. We'll skip down to verse 66 to 69. From that time many of his disciples went back and walked no more with him. Then said Jesus unto the 12, Will ye also go away? Then Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? Thou hast the words of eternal life. And we believe and are sure that thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Likewise, we are sure that he is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and we show or loudly proclaim his death and victory over sin in the memorials before us. Before partaking of these memorials, we'd like to turn to and read 1 Corinthians 11, 23 to 28. For sake of recording, I'll go ahead and stop.